This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's looking very much like New York City is, for now, the epicenter of the COVID-19 crisis here in the United States and perhaps the world. It's a very difficult time to be a New Yorker. The number of confirmed cases is doubling every 3 days, and there's not nearly enough hospital beds and equipment for the influx of patients into the city's hospitals. One hospital in Queens had 13 dead in a single day. And Andrew Cuomo, New York's governor, lashed out last week at the federal government's response.
FEMA says we're sending 400 ventilators. Really? What am I going to do with 400 ventilators when I need 30,000? You pick the 26,000 people who are going to die because you only sent 400 ventilators.
Cuomo got extra ventilators from FEMA eventually, but New York is still on an alarming trajectory. And the full scope of the crisis is already being seen in the city's emergency rooms. Dr. Jessica Van Voorhees is an ER doctor at Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn, and I caught up with her on Thursday as the city's number of confirmed cases passed 20,000. Doctor, how are you doing today?
Another bright and sunny morning, but a little crazy at work, obviously.
Well, tell me what you're seeing this morning.
Well, our numbers certainly continue to rise. I haven't started my shift yet, but I'm ready to go in again as soon as we get off the phone, actually. but, you know, I've been amazed at how many healthy young people I've seen with really severe enough disease to be admitted to the hospital. It's very unusual for me to admit a completely healthy 34-year-old, but I've had patients like that who are in their 30s. Or early 40s who have no real health problems and are getting admitted to the hospital because they need oxygen. They're struggling to breathe. That's really very unusual. And just the volume, you know, it would be typical in a 12-hour shift to intubate one patient who's critically ill, maybe two, three would be a lot. You would have had a crazy busy shift. And the last shift I worked, I intubated 10 patients in 12 hours.
Now, officially, there are 20,000 confirmed cases here in the city, and we know that testing has really lagged behind where we'd want it to be in a terrible way.
Yeah.
Based on what you're seeing, what would you estimate the true total number of cases are at in the city?
Enormously, enormously larger than that. So we, each day, and, you know, each day at my hospital, we're turning away hundreds of patients who definitely have COVID-19.
You're turning away hundreds every day who definitely have it.
Yes, for sure. More than 100. I would say maybe even 200. Monday is typically a busy day. So last Monday, our volume was down. Like the number of patients who came to the ED was down. But obviously with all those intubations, the acuity was up. The thing that's wild too is now seeing case after case after case after case for the past 2 weeks, you know, they really form a pattern. And like I said, some have more GI, gastrointestinal symptoms, some more respiratory, but you can sort of recognize it, you know, pretty quickly at this point when you just see patient after patient. I mean, I almost feel like if another emergency physician tried to tell me that 98% of the patients they're seeing in the ER are all the same disease, I mean, you would never believe it. You say, oh, you must be exaggerating. There's no way they all have it. You just think they all have it. But seriously, every single patient who's presenting to the ED, almost every single patient really has signs and symptoms of this illness. And even when patients are presenting for something else, for example, oh, I, you know, tripped and twisted my ankle coming down my front steps this morning. If they say they have a broken ankle and they need surgery and you do a chest x-ray, there are all these patients like that that we are incidentally finding that they have COVID-19 in their lungs when we go looking for something else.
Wow.
I think we're underestimating the problem, not by a few hundred people, but by thousands or tens of thousands.
The anxiety level must be very high too. I understand that you work at a call center as a doctor at the end of the line, giving advice to paramedics in the field in all five boroughs.
Yeah.
Can you give me a sense of what those phone calls are like these days?
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, our EMTs and paramedics in the field are really seeing a lot. And the level of busy, you know, the number of 911 calls the past 2 days has been, again, kind of like orders of magnitude greater than normal. A typical busy day is anything over 4,000 calls in a single day for 911 calls to the fire department. And the past 2 days, we've seen more than 6,000 calls. So
wow,
that's
wow.
Completely crazy. I mean, like, which is amazing too, because, you know, I'm not sure it'll be interesting to see what all of those calls are. But a lot of them, I definitely can tell you, because I get involved in the patients who are cardiac arrest patients. I can tell you that the volume of cardiac arrests in the past 2 days has been astronomical.
You're in an emergency room. We've heard over and over again that doctors in ER do not have the masks, the gowns, the equipment, the basic equipment they need to do the job.
Thankfully, I absolutely do. So my hospital system has done a good job of gathering enough masks and gowns and gloves. We have everything we need. I've been, I'm very thankful, and I actually feel really supported by the hospital system. There's been a big push by physicians and nurses in other areas of the hospital to really preserve that PPE for the emergency department.
That's personal protection equipment, right?
Yes. And so there is that fear of running out. And certainly we've heard horror stories from other hospitals, about running out of equipment.
I think we just heard a report about some healthcare worker using a garbage bag as a personal protective equipment at one of the...
I know. I saw that picture, which is awful. I mean, probably works. And, it certainly is like an impervious plastic. It's not a bad choice. But clearly, you'd rather have something that's made for the task. And the truth is, you know, if you're resorting to garbage bags, then it just makes you worry about, like, you know, what other equipment they're lacking and don't have available.
The CDC recently changed its guidelines to allow the reuse of surgical and N95 masks. It even suggests that healthcare workers could use bandanas or scarves as a last result. How do you feel about that?
Well, so we all agree that, and even the CDC said this, that it's, you know, non-ideal. And any infectious disease expert that you speak to will tell you that is subpar. I think it's the sort of lands in the category of something is better than nothing. But I think we all are pretty thankful that we're not there yet. There's such an outpouring of support from the community. So I've gotten so many offers from well-meaning friends and relatives to sort of like get out their sewing machines and sew me some cloth masks. And I keep having to tell people it's okay. I have appropriate PPE at work. Like, thanks anyway, but maybe save them for later for when we actually do run out someday down the road.
Have you been tested for the virus?
I have not. The indication for testing is symptoms, and I have not had any symptoms.
So medical workers are not being tested routinely unless they show symptoms?
Correct.
Is that dangerous?
I think it's okay. You know, what we are doing is just wearing a mask. So if I had the virus and I didn't want to spread it to another person, what I would do is wear a surgical mask. And I'm wearing a surgical mask or higher levels of PPE at work anyway, with every single patient.
Are you concerned that it's a silly question to ask. Are you concerned that you're going to get a coronavirus? It sounds to me like you assume you are almost.
Yeah, I do almost assume that we all are. And I'm not worried about it.
Why is that?
Because for most people, it's really a mild illness. I'm 43. My overall mortality rate, if you look elsewhere in the world, is maybe 0.2%. So, you know, those are pretty good odds.
As soon as we get off the phone, I know you're going to head to the hospital and begin your shift again. What is the mood mm-hmm. in the room? How does it feel to be in that room in the ER?
Kind of surreal, kind of unbelievable. And we're certainly in the thick of it. It just, you wonder how much more you can do. And then, you know, we just try to keep expanding areas where we're seeing these patients. And, you know, we have a tent outside to see these patients. We've, you know, used areas, surgical clinics and areas of the hospital that we wouldn't normally use to see ER patients. We're just sort of taking over every spare bit of real estate in the hospital. And I think we're going to have to continue to do that. So it really changes by the day, and it's certainly not good. It's wild to see something really unfold before your eyes, and you read about it in the paper, and it's happening right in front of you day by day.
Doctor, as a New Yorker, as a... as someone whose brother is an ER doctor, and just as a fellow human being, I thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I know all New Yorkers do.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Dr. Jessica Van Voorhees is an ER doctor at Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn, and I spoke with her this past Thursday. Doctors and nurses caring for COVID patients are facing a situation they've just never seen before. With no specific treatment for the virus available yet, patients are mostly being offered supportive care with the hope that the illness will eventually subside. And that has represented a huge shift in how many doctors are used to practicing medicine. Sana Joffrey is a physician at the Providence Regional Medical Center north of Seattle, and she's worked directly there with COVID patients. She spoke to the Radio Hour's Stephen Valentino last week about how her day-to-day work life has changed.
So my typical day before all of this pandemic really became an issue, I would see anywhere between 14 to 17 patients. And nowadays, I can see anywhere between 17 to, you're told to be prepared to see up to 25 patients a day. So my day begins with me making a list of patients that I know are positive, patients that are potential rule-outs, and then some regular patients who don't have coronavirus. And I try to see my patients who don't have coronavirus first, just so that there's less risk of exposure. And also to get a little bit more upbeat, you know. I think I myself, and probably a lot of my colleagues, I can say, you know, one of the best parts about being a doctor is that when you're taking care of these patients, you get to learn so much about them. Like, I will sit in their room, I'm talking to them about what life was like before they came here, what events are they looking forward to, and so that when I know about their healthcare issues, I know about them, their family, in the broader, you know, context. Whereas after this, I go see my COVID patients or COVID rule-out patients, I will mask up like this. I wear gloves, I wear a gown, and then I wear another set of gloves. I wear a mask and then protective eyewear. And so they don't get to see me basically at all because I'm just eyes behind a mask and this protective eyewear. So they don't get to see if I'm smiling at them. And you lose a lot. You lose a lot in that. I don't get to sit there and hear about, you know, their niece's wedding that's coming up, or how they manage at home, or what they like to eat and things like this. It's mostly just business. And I don't get to know about them, which means that they don't stick in my mind like other patients used to.
It kind of sounds like being a COVID patient is kind of a lonely experience.
It is. It's very lonely. It's very lonely. You don't, you know, usually a typical patient will have a CNA, a nurse, some type of therapist who's coming to see them, and the doctor, if not multiple doctors. Whereas these patients will probably have all of these things, but once a day, you know, and the bare minimum. They might not be seeing physical therapists. They might not be seeing, you know, occupational therapist or all the specialists, because again, the goal is to minimize exposure. So it's whatever is necessary. And they're not allowed visitors. So they have no family who can come and see them. And I think that's one of the, it's difficult. It is very difficult to be isolated in that room for multiple days.
Dr. Sana Jaffrey works at Providence Everett Hospital in Everett, Washington. And she spoke with the Radio Hour's Stephen Valentino. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're in a time now of terrible uncertainty in just about every aspect of our national life, not least in our politics. Whether the pandemic brings us to a greater sense of common good really remains to be seen. Some in the business community and on the right are now arguing that widespread death may be preferable to the economic depression that follows from containing the virus. And President Trump, meanwhile, is insisting that the country be brought back to work by Easter. And all through this, there's a presidential primary race still going on, and we have no idea how the pandemic will affect the November election. To get some insight on all of this, I called up the New Yorker's Washington correspondent, Susan Glasser. Susan, hi.
Hi, David.
Now, you've called this crisis the most clarifying of Donald Trump's presidency. What do you mean by that?
Well, look, I mean, all crises reveal, and what we're seeing is the man in full, with all of his limitations, his character quirks, and the strengths and weaknesses of his administration. And by sort of waging war on the institutions of government as we know it for the last few years, creating and constructing a White House that runs or doesn't run unlike any other of any Republican or Democratic president, those are the tools that he brings to this most unusual battle. And you couldn't imagine a president personalizing a crisis with a virus, but somehow that's where we are. That's where we are. The Trump show applies even to the pandemic.
What do you mean by personalizing this crisis?
Well, look at one of these daily press conferences that he's now been holding in the White House briefing room. And what do you hear? You hear the word I an awful lot. And you hear a president who's dramatizing this as if it's something that is affecting him and him alone. He talks over and over again about how awful the coronavirus test was that he had to take, which is literally consists of a swab that was shoved up his nose. And, you know, same thing with the economy. I had the best economy. It was growing great. It was the best in world history. Can you believe this happened? Nobody expected this to happen. And on and on and on it goes. And it's this sort of very narcissistic kind of stream of consciousness approach to a crisis.
It's really well documented that the president played down the seriousness of this pandemic for a long time. And do we have any sense of why that is?
You know, this week was the 1 month anniversary of the president's first substantive tweet about the coronavirus. On February 24th, he said, essentially, this is not coming to the USA in a big way, and we're all going to be fine, and it's not going to really happen here. February 24th, that was more than a month after his own government had been warning him that steps needed to be taken that weren't taken. So there might be in the future some sort of a 9/11 style commission to look at why that was. But I think, you know, with Trump, sometimes the answer is pretty transparent. And in this case, I think the answer is pretty transparent. He didn't want anything to interrupt his reelection campaign plan, which entirely hinged on the strength of the U.S. economy and also the strength of the U.S. stock market, which had hit its highest point in February. And that's the risk of personalizing government, where his overwhelming need for a personal political resurrection after his impeachment and trial absolutely overrode the increasingly dire warnings that it seems he was getting from inside his government as well as outside.
This kind of reaction, which may be understandable for an ordinary citizen, at least temporarily, seems to me inexcusable for the leader of a country, that he, rather than face the facts of a growing hurricane of cases, illnesses, death, shortages in hospitals, reacts the way he is by saying we're going to be back by Easter. And this has to be enormously confusing to so many people in the United States and is likely to cause behavior that leads to tragic consequences.
David, that's the essence of it that's so striking, is that in the end, when the catastrophe came and hit Trump, it was one that had to do with public health and where his flimflammery and narcissism and insistence upon creating, constructing, and projecting alternate realities would collide with empirical reality in such a stark way. The math is the math. Look at those charts. Look at those numbers. X number of people are sick 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now. X number of people are going to be suffering and dying. We have X number of ventilators. And so I think that really hit home for many people this Tuesday when the president, in the face of that overwhelming scientific and empirical reality, was simply declaring willfully, well, I insist that, you know, I would like to reopen the country by Easter, and have people packed into pews. And it's painful to watch it because it gets to the essence of Trump and why he's different than all other presidents of yours in my lifetime. It's not about ideology. It's about the unique flaws in his character. And for me, that's what makes him so potentially dangerous in this particular kind of a crisis.
We've got truth tellers, whatever flaws you may ascribe to them over time, but you have truth tellers like Anthony Fauci and Andrew Cuomo, who are speaking straight to the president, how is, from your understanding of what's going on inside, how are their conversations with the president going? Are they reaching him at any level? Does he just ignore them? Does he push back? How are those conversations going?
Well, it seems to be almost erratic in the extreme, based on the accounts that you've heard from Fauci and Cuomo in various interviews. They both claim that the president does listen at times, that, you know, the sort of abrasive, attacking personality that you and I observe in his public performances is not always the case in private. And you see that with Trump, who has a sort of love-hate relationship with Cuomo, right? He often speaks of the fact that, oh, well, we get along really well. And then 10 minutes later, he'll attack him publicly and suggest that New York State is going to suffer in terms of federal aid because they're not being, quote, nice to him. And again, they have the problem of needing to speak the truth, maintain their own credibility with the public and with their own teams. But at the same time, we all know that if you alienate Trump too much, you know, that is a real risk.
He'll throw you out the door.
Well, and again, the public safety of New York State in the case of Cuomo and the country in the case of Fauci, to a certain extent, involves them not having some catastrophic rift with the president. And so that's a very, very delicate line that they have to tread. And it really is so worrisome. We've already seen the president publicly attacking numerous governors, mostly of heavily Democratic states. You know, he went after Governor Pritzker in Illinois. He's gone after Cuomo at various points. He's attacked many figures who are crucial to the actual on-the-ground response to the pandemic.
But there's one result in terms of the pandemic. There's another in terms of public opinion. Gallup released a poll which found that the president had a 49% approval rating, which is high for him, with 60% approving of his handling of the crisis. What's driving his numbers so high, assuming that everything that you've said is true?
Well, that's right. It is a remarkable phenomenon. So two things we've seen since the beginning of the Trump presidency. Number one, views about Donald Trump are remarkably fixed and immune to almost any kind of external change or shock. And so no matter what Trump has said and done over the last few years, you know, he's had this core of a little bit more than 40% of the country in these opinion polls that have supported him. And then a small group of waverers. And now what you're seeing in that Gallup survey is remarkable. Essentially, the people who have gone back and forth on Trump, that small number of people who remain undecided, have swung back to approving of his conduct in office for the last few years. You don't see Democrats changing their mind about the president. And I think that's the other thing as far as the politics of this moment go that is notable, which is that you have essentially blue America and red America, very partisan and divided country right now. They're at least initially experiencing the pandemic in a very different blue state, red state way. And so you have the big cities that are predominantly Democratic on the two coasts are being hit first and hardest by this. And Trump seems to be exacerbating those divisions that already exist in the country with how he's talking about this and some of his rhetoric about wanting to return to normalcy and how it's not really that big of a deal, essentially are playing almost overtly to small, less populated states in the middle of the country that so far have not been hard hit. He actually mentioned the other day, you know, Nebraska and Idaho, you know, they can go back to work. And so you see the president playing off of those political divides in our country at a time when others would speak of national unity. He seems to be speaking and encouraging division.
Are there any Republican senators who are breaking with the president? We see Lindsey Graham, in a sense, Lindsey Graham, arguing with this approach that the cure can't be worse than the problem.
Yes, but to me, what's striking, as it has been throughout the Trump presidency, is the deafening lack of public pushback from Republican senators, Republican House members. I think that's the most remarkable thing, where you are hearing some rumblings And some pushback is among Republican governors and officials at the state and local level, whose job it is to actually protect the public safety. So Governor Mike DeWine in Ohio, Governor Larry Hogan in Maryland, those have been two of the loudest and most effective Republican state officials in terms of their clear-eyed response to the pandemic. And implicitly, their behavior and their public statements have been a rebuke to Trump almost every day. In fact, Larry Hogan, the other day, when Donald Trump said he wants to bring the country back to work by Easter Sunday, Larry Hogan just came out and said, this is fake. This is an imaginary timeline. And no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that may be true. And it is. But the lieutenant governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, suggested on Fox News, on Tucker Carlson's show, that senior citizens shouldn't put their personal safety from coronavirus ahead of the health of the economy.
You know, my message is that let's get back to work. Let's get back to living. Let's be smart about it. And those of us who are 70 plus, we'll take care of ourselves, but don't sacrifice the country. Don't do that. Don't ruin
this
great American dream.
So you're basically saying that this disease could take your life, but that's not the scariest thing to you. There's something that would be worse than dying.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing to hear that. It's really stunning. I, you know, personally, I'm not ready to sacrifice my parents for the views of, you know, some Wall Street financiers. I have to tell you, it's just shocking that people say things like that out loud. You know, they always joke that Trump is the one who says the part out loud. Well, you often have some of his followers now doing that. And by the way, David, it's not isolated to the Texas lieutenant governor. There are some senators who have said eerily similar things and who have been downplaying the public health risks of this from the very beginning. You know, Senator Johnson from Wisconsin has said similar, if not quite so colorful, versions of the same thing. And so, you know,
well, look again, at Rand Paul, who tested positive for coronavirus.
His father, Ron Paul, wrote a column essentially saying the whole thing was a hoax. And then, of course, Senator Paul himself, a medical doctor, an ophthalmologist who ought to know better, went around the U.S. Capitol and put his colleagues' lives in danger, many of whom, as we know, are quite old and therefore at much higher risk from this particular disease. Rand Paul went around the Capitol for, I believe it was more than 5 days.
Joe Biden has been not completely eliminated from the scene. We've heard from him here and there, but it's almost as if the election is no longer going on, it seems.
Isn't that remarkable? I mean, it's an aspect of our national life that's been put almost on hold. And on the one hand, you know, I see a lot of political professionals suggesting that, you know, Biden should just step out of the way and let, you know, Trump implode himself. You know, obviously, many of us look at the situation and say Donald Trump is sabotaging himself and his political fortunes better than any opposition candidate ever could. The stream of lies and mistruths, the incompetence, the failures, you would think that would be a very powerful record he's assembling of opposition research. You saw actually, though, that the Biden campaign clearly is worried that they're too far out of the news cycle, and they started to have Joe Biden appearing this week in daily appearances from his confinement, or whatever we're calling this quarantine era movement. So he's appearing and giving his own sort of counter briefing. So, you know, do you attack Trump right now, or do you just sort of stand out of the way and let him shoot himself in the foot, metaphorically?
Susan, finally, Ronald Reagan once remarked that the most terrifying words in the English language were, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." How does that statement hold up these days?
You know, it's remarkable when you see Republican senators and Democratic senators rushing together to pass a $2 trillion bailout package for the U.S. economy in a matter of hours and days. The same Republican senators who wouldn't do anything like that in any other circumstance. Politicians, regardless of what their ideology, and that includes Ronald Reagan, are willing to throw money at a problem when it's a problem like this one. But you do feel that the sustained Republican attack on the institutions of our government, on the very idea that it can be an agent of help, has contributed to what appears to be the incompetence and disorganization of the Trump administration's response to this. There'll be plenty of time. We'll be hashing over what happened and what didn't happen in this national crisis for many years to come, I suspect. But the role of Republicans and specifically the Trump administration in how it handled this, there's going to be some shocking stuff, I imagine, that we learn when it all comes out.
Susan Glasser, thank you so much.
David, thank you.
Susan Glasser is a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, and you can read her work at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I think all of us are feeling like social distancing is pushing us a little too close to the edge. And I don't mean to belittle that feeling at all, but for some people, the lack of direct contact is a genuine threat. Alcoholics Anonymous and many addiction treatment groups depend on in-person meetings. Reagan Reed is the executive director of the New York Intergroup Association of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's also a member of AA herself. The Radio Hour's Rhiannon Corby called up Reed a little more than a week ago, just as organizations all over the country were shutting down.
I mean, do you want to start by telling me, like, what the past 72 hours have been like for you?
They've been completely chaotic. I think I've been sleeping about 2.5 or 3 hours a night. We have over 5,000 meetings in just the New York City area. And most of them are shutting down, and nobody knows what to do. We have some young people who are able to easily set up Zoom meetings, for example. But for our kind of older AA community, it's been especially hard. What we're doing, what I'm doing now, is trying to set up sort of like an AA emergency Zoom center so that we can host 10 meetings every hour with up to 300 participants each.
And what's your fear with having those meetings close or go digital? Like, how is that different for people attending these groups?
It's a tremendous, tremendous difference. The way that our fellowship works is that we sit in a room together and we talk to one another face to face. The meetings are the cornerstone and foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. So removing them is it's going to have a really big impact on people's ability to remain sober.
I mean, just think about, like, that decision to start closing stuff down, and, like, were you part of that decision?
I personally, with the permission of my board, made the decision to close down our central office. Mm-hmm. And our central office is where all of our volunteers answer phones and provide a web chat service on our website. And we've never shut down the office before, even during, you know, our harshest blizzards. So what I had to do was then immediately set up remote call forwarding shifts, which I did. And we've been able to keep the phones and web chat on during those hours just by doing really 24/7 hour outreach.
And it seems like, you know, on top of not being able to go to meetings, like this has just been incredibly sort of like alienating time for everyone. Like I can imagine that it would feel more important than ever to kind of, you know, show up and be able to talk about stuff with people.
Absolutely. I mean, that everybody's anxiety is higher and, you know, a lot of alcoholics suffer from depression and, you know, problems outside of alcohol and all of those things, those other isms are blowing up. You know, my own anxiety is much higher than it was 72 hours ago. And for most of us who are in the program, who have hit a rock bottom in our drinking days, you always go back to where you ended, you know, so things progress and they get much worse every time you relapse. I am an alcoholic, and it's been very hard. I have not been able to go to a meeting since Wednesday. The meetings that I go to are closed, and I am personally just talking to my sponsor and trying to just take care of my basic needs, which is often the hardest thing for alcoholics, you know, just eating and mm-hmm. sleeping. You know, I think that, you know, we've been discussing things that are very bleak. But I also wanted to say that we have a program that's been going on since 1946 and has grown by millions and millions of people and is shared all over the world. And it's a very solid and remarkable fellowship. And I think that within our own communities, you know, we're going to find a way through and get through it. And we should be okay.
Reagan Reed, an executive with Alcoholics Anonymous in New York. She spoke about a week ago with Rhiannon Corvey of the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now, to help alleviate some of this despair and boredom, I've called up my friend and colleague Gia Tolentino, a staff writer who's holed up right now at an undisclosed location upstate. Gia, I'm calling you from Manhattan, and you are somewhere upstate, right?
I'm upstate in the snow.
How is it? Is it at least beautiful to look out the window?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, also the key is that now my boyfriend and I don't have to take, you know, phone calls in the same 250-foot square foot space and, you know, incite each other to murder. So it's delightful up here.
Yeah, it's you got to wonder how divorce lawyers are going to do in the wake of all this.
Well, you know, COVID spelled backward is almost divorce. So
yeah. Let me ask you this. Your job today is to please make us a little happy or a little happier than is thought to be humanly possible in these circumstances. What's keeping you sane upstate?
Well, so where should we start? So there's one good Instagram account that has sprung up in, I think, just the last week. It's called Work From Home Fits. It's at WFH Fits. And it is just a selfie gallery of people sending in their, you know, totally insane work from home outfits.
Well, how do you mean? What are you seeing?
Oh, you know, let me pull it up right now. I mean, we've got...
Oh, my God.
We've got robes. We've got blankets as skirts. We've got formal evening gowns worn with Birkenstock slippers. We've got... You know, We've got a nice blouse and I Love New York boxer shorts. It's
I got to tell you, Gia, this one guy here in a green leather jacket, I've never looked that good in my life out of the house, much less
well,
bunking
this
inside.
Account is run by fashion editors, and I think it, you know, it is featuring a lot of cool people. I mean, I look terrible, but I think it's like, I like this account because it reminds you that being seen by each other, it is actually a sort of lifeline. It can be salutary and not oppressive.
Yeah.
And I think like the way we dress on a daily basis is we're trying to give each other pleasure as much as anything. You know what? One of the things that me and my friends have been doing on our group text is just doing a little selfie roll call, you know, periodically throughout the day, just sending a little roll call of what you're doing, how you look. And it is a true mood booster.
What's been your best outfit through the course of this?
Oh, I look terrible all the time, but I'm wearing, you know, I'm wearing old like college sorority sweatshirts. It's really a bad scene. But the thing is, I always look terrible all the time because I always work at home. You know, I was born in this darkness, so I'm used to it.
Now, what else is keeping you sane, Gia?
Have you ever read that Irene Nemirovsky novel, Sweet Française?
I have.
It's so good, right? Do you like it?
I do. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, that novel, I have two copies of it and I lent them both out last week, like dropped them on my friend's doorsteps, like contactless delivery, you know, and that novel feels... It starts with the German occupation of France. I think that we're all looking for comparisons for this time. And there is some vague wartime feeling to this. And I think, you know, like people are making lots of jokes about reading Proust or, you know, rereading War and Peace or whatever. And to me, I'm like, no, everyone should just read Sweet Française because it is kind of Proustian. It is kind of Tolstoy-ish. It has that fullness, the kind of sensory enveloping quality. And, you know, and it's a really good book about like, you know, disruption and sheltering in place and love, I think, right?
It's a great suggestion. I made the mistake, although, you know, maybe it's professional mistake, of reading John Barry's The Great Influenza about 1918. And
I've been thinking about, should I not read that?
You might want to skip that for a few days. It's a superb history of the flu epidemic in 1918, but God almighty.
Yeah, but there's a way in which, you know, it's like, I feel like I am often trying to tamp down my anxiety by exacerbating it. And it actually, reading like a novel off the screen is the only way I can keep myself from just, you know, not turning, even if I'm watching something on my computer, I end up being like, well, what's new in, you know, what's the count in Spain today? Like I have to be off a screen to calm down, I think.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Gia, what else is going to save my life right now, or at least save my sanity?
So I strongly recommend pulling up a window that does not involve email or Zoom. The Monterey Bay Aquarium's live jellyfish cam. it's incredible. It runs every day during work hours.
I got it. Third link.
So I've been obsessed with jellyfish ever since I read this wild New York Review of Books article on jellyfish in like 2013 or something. And, you know, it's like talking about, you know, the immortal jellyfish that they can live forever, and the ones that you can't differentiate, like they don't know whether to call the jellyfish a singular or a plural. They're wild. And I've never been able to meditate, though people keep telling me that it would be good for me. And I have found that this jellyfish cam, which is unbelievably beautiful, you know, is the next best thing.
It looks like, and I'm looking at it on my phone right now, it looks like what used to play behind psychedelic bands in the late 60s and 70s.
Maybe that's why I like it.
Now, what else is keeping you sane, Gia?
Do you know the artist Caribou?
I don't.
So it's this guy, Dan Snaith, and Caribou is sort of, it's this sort of intimate, like mesmerizing, really joyful, really pleading kind of housey electronic music. His last album was called Our Love, and it came out in 2014. And the title track from that song, it was my number one favorite thing for like a year to listen to whenever I was on the subway. It was sort of this like wordless meditation on connection and love. And it made me cry all the time in public, and I never cry. And this new album, which is called Suddenly, like it really couldn't have come at a better time. I feel like I'm listening to a lot of things that the music I'm listening to is the music that can supply the vibes that I myself cannot produce for myself at this moment. And for this album, it's sort of a focus and a command and a joy, like a quiet joy that's hard, that's usually pretty easy for me to access, but it's a little harder when you're alone all day. I mean, everyone's alone all day and going a little nuts. Something that you never had. One of my favorite tracks on the album is the fourth song. It's called New Jade. And it's sort of this kind of very relentless, almost psychedelic track that to me, there's this part in midway through the song that sounds, it sounds like what it's gonna feel like to go out dancing with a bunch of strangers and with my friends once this is all over. Don't you believe what he says? It's always lies.
You're thinking about that a lot, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's nice to remember when this is over, the amount of joy we're going to feel just to be in each other's presences again, you know, the like how good it's going to feel just to hug somebody or to meet a stranger and hug them, to, you know, be around strangers' sort of skin and their voices and the sort of mess of being a human and have it feel good again.
Yeah. Gia, well, that all those recommendations sound like deliverance itself. We'll see you soon, I hope.
Thanks, David.
Take care, Gia. You can find hours and hours of great reading by Gia Tolentino at newyorker.com. Not to mention her best-selling collection called Trick Mirror, wherever books are still being sold. I'm David Remnick, and I want to thank you for listening. However the COVID emergency is affecting you, I wish you and your families the very best. Good health to all of you. We'll be back next week with more of the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.